Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall Credit Card Bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex.
And welcome back to On Air, the final episode of this season before we come back later in the summer. How's it going,
yes.
Alex?
All good. How are you?
I am great. I was very excited to enjoy a Swedish summer until I realized that it is 15 degrees and rainy every single day. And it reminded me why I'm not a huge proponent. As much as I love summer in Scandinavia, I also think it's very risky. So I generally just advise people, unless Scandinavia is like your dream destination for some reason, don't risk it, because the weather, you'll never know if it will be good.
I mean, very few people are going with, surely there are very few people are going with the whole kind of beach holiday thing in mind, but instead it's about the nature and the hiking and the, I mean, maybe even the northern lights. And they're putting on quite a display this week, by the way. I don't know if you saw.
Really?
So it's one of those solar storms, and it can be seen in really kind of southern areas, across stretching from almost middle America, and then if you kind of draw a line across the globe, right through. So it was most visible earlier this week, but that's set to continue over the next few days, and it's usually after midnight. Again, difficult if there's light pollution to see with the naked eye, but the iPhone can definitely see it. I saw it last night.
Wow. In the UK?
Yeah, it's visible in the UK. Actually, it's been visible across most of Europe, at least kind of, let's say, from Madrid and above. And that's, again, because of that solar storm. We had that last year, Dan, in May, where people were seeing it right across Canada and also different parts of the US. So it's an interesting one. And also keep an eye out if you're flying, because some great views. Another reason to keep that window shade open, as we always preach about.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, just when it comes to Scandinavia, I think people are going for the outdoors and all that. So when the weather isn't great, it's not really worth going. But it is summer. True. It's the first week of June. What is going on in aviation?
Quite a bit. I mean, there's some stuff I want to talk to you about that's happening in the Maldives in relation to their new terminal. And you are my go-to Maldives kind of not just guide, but source of info, because you do travel there pretty frequently, way more frequently than anyone else I know. You know many of the islands really well. And I know that news about the new terminal will matter to you. Also happening this week is the IATA AGM, so we can touch on that in a bit. But what's happening in that second home of yours that other people call paradise?
Second home, not quite, but the Maldives. So obviously, the Maldives has become an increasingly popular destination in the past decade, with every year more and more airlines are flying there. There's more and more capacity. BA now flies their biggest aircraft there daily in the winter, which is quite a contrast to just a few years ago. So there's a lot of demand. And what was originally happening was that the airport is built on largely reclaimed land, a separate island right next to the capital. So there's a bridge that connects them. But before that bridge, which was only opened a few years ago, you had to take a boat to get to the capital island, Malé. But this airport was just, I mean, the Maldives are literally little sandbanks that are at most 2 meters above sea level. So originally there was one runway, which you would taxi up and down. It would take ages for each aircraft to vacate the runway after landing, for example. So it was just incredibly inefficient. And thankfully, in the end of 2023, they opened their new runway, which you might wonder, how do you open a new runway when there is no space to open it on? They basically, there was just, they just crammed it in wherever they could, right next to the existing runway. And that existing runway was turned into a taxiway, which was a game changer, because if you flew into the Maldives in 2022, for example, when travel was really picking up there post-COVID, you probably experienced what I and thousands of other people experienced, that you would have been in a holding pattern, circling and circling before landing for potentially an hour sometimes, because the airport was so congested. So the fact they opened the new taxiway was already a game changer, because there was no more holding. Aircraft could land one after another and take off one after another. So delays at the airport have reduced significantly. But there are still only bus gates at the airport. They don't have a single contact gate at this airport that gets a dozen plus wide bodies every day and way more narrow bodies. So every passenger who lands has to get off by stairs and take a bus to a terminal that is not the best, to say the least. So the news that they're opening a new terminal building is amazing. What, I mean, from the outside, it looks pretty modern and impressive, right?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I thought it looked, well, firstly, I wasn't so across the plans for this. So that's definitely the first thing I noticed, that, okay, this seems to be popping up of nowhere. I mean, it's also opening ahead of the high season there, which is typically not these Northern Hemisphere summer months, but much later on in the calendar. So that's good news there. The other thought I was thinking about is what you had touched on about reducing the holding patterns, because, you know, I also feel sorry for the people that are saved up and they're going on this trip of a lifetime to the Maldives, which is definitely a kind of trip of the lifetime destination. And then they're holding for almost an hour, which is just not enjoyable. And then they're associating it with delays, and it's just, you know, difficult to get in. And as you say, you've had tons of experience with that. And then, of course, you have the quirk of disembarking, deplaning via stairs, which for the likes of you and I, appreciating wide body aircraft or larger aircraft, is kind of fun. We like that. And I think that's just a nice quirk that I don't mind about airports like Male. But yeah, the infrastructure there definitely needed it. And there are so many other airports that operate in this kind of island model that are crying out for extra space, but they don't have it because, as you said, it's a sandbank. I want to ask you, do you remember when you were studying in school? Let's go way back to early high school. We definitely had textbooks that had in black and white, the Maldives will be underwater by 2020.
Yeah.
that was seen as fact. And it's like, well, we're still managing to get wide bodies in there. And they're still opening up new resorts in mid-2025. So we're all right.
Yeah, paradise is fine for now. But the crazy thing also, when it comes to the delays that the airport used to have, is that the way the seaplane system works, which, if you don't know, is basically how you get around two different islands in the Maldives. Most of the time, you can also fly to certain larger local islands that have airports that handle turboprops. But in general, a large percentage of tourists take a seaplane. But seaplanes can only operate in daylight. So there's a strict rule that if your flight is landing after 3 p.m. or if you're at a closer resort, 3:30 p.m., you cannot take a transfer to the resort the same day, because there won't be time to arrive at the resort and land safely before the sun sets. If you're on a flight, for example, at least Emirates and Qatar, two of the biggest airlines to the Maldives, have flights that are scheduled to land right around that cutoff point at 3 p.m. I think specifically Emirates has a flight that lands at 2:55 p.m. just to get under that cutoff. So what happened in those days when people were circling and suddenly you missed that cutoff, and then you lose a night that you're paying $1,000, $2,000 for at your resort? That's not good. Not to mention that there aren't really any luxury hotels in the capital, and most people are going to these uber luxury resorts. So anyway, when you have all that context, and when you think about the fact that the Maldives relies so heavily on tourism at hotels that are charging some of the highest rates in the world, when you see that airport, it does not reflect that whatsoever. It is like landing in a little village in some, you know, developing country. So there's a lot of improvement that can be made. The problem is that this new flashy terminal, which I've been seeing for years landing in the Maldives, has just had delay upon delay. It's giving Berlin Brandenburg, because when I was there in December, when we arrived in the beginning of December, they said, oh, it's opening in a few days. We went, oh, that's awesome. Can't wait to try it when we fly out. Then when we left, they're like, oh no, they pushed it for 2 months. So to February. And now, of course, we're in June and they say it's going to open on July 26th, which I think is the Maldives National Day, or it's coinciding with some special occasion. So okay. I do not trust that whatsoever, because I literally heard it's opening in a few days when I was there. But for sure, this will be a game changer for people traveling to and from the country to have a terminal that hopefully matches the comfort and the beauty of the rest of the country. So let's keep our fingers crossed that it's July 26th when we finally have everything we need from Malé Airport.
For anyone that hasn't been to the Maldives, can you explain the concept of, and I think I admit I first discovered this through one of your videos ages ago, of when you, for example, arrive on a commercial flight and then you are going to another island via the seaplanes, which, as you said, is kind of the most common way to move around. And they're very expensive, these tickets on these trans-Maldivian little seaplane shuttles. Am I correct in saying that sometimes you have to wait for that seaplane, although it was scheduled to leave at, let's say, 11 in the morning, you have to wait for it to fill up if there are not sufficient number of passengers for it to ready to go? Is that correct?
So there is actually no seaplane schedule. It's not like a scheduled departure to your resort. Your hotel knows when you arrive. And then how it works is that they look at, okay, what direction are you flying? They know your intended landing time. So you're right that they wait for the plane to fill up. But usually it's just with people going in your general direction. So I've never had to wait. But how it works is that in arrivals, Arrivals looks unlike any other place in the whole world, because you get out of customs and you're greeted by like 100 outdoor hotel stands, and you behind them you see the crystal clear water of the Maldives. It's like, wow, we're here. So you go and find your hotel, and then you inform them, you give them your passport, they check you in for your hotel stay, and then they walk you to, depending on which airline you're flying, it can be Transmaldivian or Monte Air are the two main options. And then certain hotels like Four Seasons and Soneva have their own planes. So that's, I haven't experienced those, but most people are going by Transmaldivian or Monte. So you go to their check-in desks. It's like a normal airline check-in, but it's right there among the hotel desks. You you drop your check-in bags, you get your boarding pass, but the boarding pass doesn't say, you don't have a seat number, you don't have a flight number, it's just your name and the hotel you're going to. Then you get driven to the seaplane terminal, which is, it's on the same grounds as the terminal, but you have to drive maybe 10, 15 minutes because it's on the opposite side of the runway.
From the international terminal where you've arrived by commercial flight, right?
Yeah. So then you get there and you get taken to a lounge, either your hotel's lounge, because many hotels have their own lounges, which is quite cool because we're used to the concept of airline lounges. But here it's like, oh, I'm going to the St. Regis lounge, or I'm going to the Conrad lounge. Then you sit there and you wait, and they tell you when your flight is leaving. So I've never had to sit there for more than an hour. And normally at that point, it's only been about 30 minutes since you landed. So it's all very quick. And if you're lucky, you get a direct flight to your resort, which I've had a few times. Or what is the most common is that you'll be making one or two stops along the way at different resorts.
Just to clarify on that point, you mean one or two landings. So your aircraft is literally taking off and landing one or two times while you remain on board and they drop off other passengers.
Yeah. I mean, keep in mind, I think there's only capacity for 12 people on these planes. So it's not like we're waiting for 100 people, but it's such a cool experience getting each time we get to take off and land. And it's so stunning. I could sit and watch all day. I could sit in that plane.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for the fact that it's very hot and they don't have any AC, you're just relying on air from the outside, which is also very hot in the Maldives. But the cool thing is that sometimes if you've, I think maybe a couple of years ago, we stopped at two resorts before taking off to ours. But at that point, we were the last ones on board. So it was us,
one
flight attendant kind of, and the two pilots on our private seaplane to our resort for like a 2-minute ride. So yeah, definitely
we had a question, right? On this subject. This came in last week and it was part of, I mean, it's good timing because of how we had this news of the new terminal. Which is that, hey guys, so this is from Ewan. Ewan says, hey guys, I quickly want to ask, what happens when you are connecting from the main international airport to your hotel via a seaplane when the weather is bad? The Maldives is sometimes famous for storms that can last days.
Good question. As far as I've experienced, the seaplanes operate in all weather. So I've flown in storms. I've flown when the waves were massive and you still take off and land on them. I think at a certain point, yeah, you might have to wait, but this is a tropical country, so the weather changes by the minute. I don't think I've never experienced a full day of just complete thunderstorm, torrential downpour. You might have that for an hour or two, so you might have to sit and wait, but eventually they'll take you. I don't know what happens if you land close to the cutoff and there's torrential downpour at that point, but I'm pretty sure worst case scenario, they would fly you to the closest main island to the hotel on a commercial airline. Yeah. So you'd be flying on an ATR, and then from there they might pick you up on a speedboat. But I think it's very uncommon.
The funny part is what you just said. I mean, you're saying that they fly in all weather, right? Okay, so I'm like, great. So not only do you face the prospect of bumpy air, but also wavy sea. I mean, you're literally talking about these two things coming together in one. So not only is it rocking in the water as a seaplane, like a boat would, and then you're in the air, and then you've got bumpy air. And,
you know, 100%.
I don't know. That's not for the faint-hearted if there is bad weather and you're slightly nervous about.
And then the pilots are flying barefoot, and you can see them because the cockpit is open.
That's famous, isn't it?
But I will say I feel very safe in seaplanes because it's like, what's going to happen? We're only flying over ocean and we can literally land anywhere. So I'm never stressing out about that. And even in bad weather, I feel like, you know, we're good.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, there's obviously the added backup measures there that the rest of the world's aircraft don't have in terms of not needing a runway, but having all of the Indian Ocean as their runway. So yeah, it's cool. When just to close up this topic, when is the best time that you would advise people to visit, and your kind of best experiences have been via the seaplane route or these hotels that now offer no seaplane headache, recognizing that a lot of people come from really, really far. The last thing they want is to then get another fly. You can just simply hop on a speedboat.
Yeah, well, just the speedboat resorts are only very close to the capital. So if you're staying at one of those hotels, then they won't even offer us a seaplane. It's only a speedboat option. But the drawback of those hotels, in my opinion, is that being closer to the capital, it's more likely there will be plastic bottles floating in the water or other trash. Mm. There will be ships going by. When you're at these remote islands that you need to spend 45 minutes on a seaplane to get to, then you're truly in the middle of nowhere. There will not be any trash nearby or anything like that, which is what makes it amazing. Traditionally, December to end of April is dry season, but climate change has messed all of that up. So there's not really one time you can guarantee good weather, kind of like in Sweden. But the difference is that even on a bad day, the Maldives is stunning, while Sweden on a bad day makes me want to hop on the next flight out of it.
I'm amazed at how there's definitely something that I've been unaware of before we hit record today, that there's some kind of resentment you have today specifically against your home country, and yet we're moving into the season where, you know, Scandinavia, light evenings until almost midnight, like this is the best time of year. I understand if you're depressed and in Sweden in, you know, January.
Yeah, the problem is that I was supposed to fly there yesterday, but I ended up not deciding to go because the weather is so terrible and I had to pay hundreds of dollars to change my flights. So that's why I'm a bit like, we had planned all this to spend 3 lovely weeks with our families in Sweden, and then the weather is going to be absolutely terrible according to the forecast. So we're like, well, we literally couldn't make plans. This is such a first world problem, I know, but in the end, we ain't going there if it's like this. So for now we're staying clear, but we did have to pay a bit to change those plans. So that's why I'm frustrated right now.
That's a decent segue into the fact that obviously we are now categorically at the peak segment of the calendar for summer travel. So most summer travel globally in the Northern Hemisphere summer will take off now between right now, the beginning of June, and the end of August. This is when the most people will be traveling throughout the calendar year, and including that massive demographic of people that aren't traveling the rest of the year, but are traveling for a summer break between June and the end of August. So this is now peak period for airlines. This is where most airlines will make most of their money, and hopefully for airlines, not just revenue, but their profit during the next 12 weeks. It's when schools across much of the Northern Hemisphere will take some time off, either earlier or later, or sometimes stretching all of it, which adds to the demographic of people flying. And as I said, it's when many of our listeners will be traveling, and perhaps they haven't traveled earlier this year and maybe won't later this year, but will be traveling this period. And so we are go. I have been speaking to airlines to discuss how they're preparing for this summer travel period now, and also if they're confident on how smooth it's going to play out. Because if you remember how disruptive 2022 was, that was the big comeback from COVID, and there was literally no staff to enable that comeback, and it was chaos. 2023 was a little bit better. 2024 summer, very, very smooth and very profitable for airlines, and airlines are hoping to build on that this summer. What has been your experience so far? I mean, already as I've been traveling to different places, mostly actually just for day trips for work, the airports are noticeably busier. There are kids about now. There are countries that have already broken up for the long summer period. Those queues are longer. The aircraft are just that bit busier. And then it's interesting to see how this is all being managed. What do you think? What have you seen?
Well, I haven't been at an airport for the past 10 days or so, and then it was, I guess, quite normal. Yeah, I know, 10 days for me is crazy, right? But then it was quite normal. But I will say that trying to find award seats for going back to Sweden has been tricky. And I don't want to keep harping on about this, but I've realized that, interestingly, over the past couple years, the connections to Gothenburg have gotten so much worse, which is weird because in summer, I always expect 5 daily flights on Lufthansa, 4 daily flights on BA, which is what we had some years. But now I'm wondering where the capacity is shifting or what's going on, because there really is not that much capacity. And that means that prices are crazy. So I was looking at connecting through Amsterdam, and KLM, the coming week from Amsterdam to Gothenburg in economy class was over $350 per person one way for a 1 hour flight on every frequency every single day, which tells me we're in summer because those prices are highway robbery.
you're right. I mean, just a quick, so I mean the IATA AGM that's happening now, some of the airline chiefs have commented on this summer. And the expectation is that, yes, fares are slightly higher than last year, with no real obvious reason as to why, apart from the blame game. The T word is being thrown about, tariffs, as we've warned, and as we had previously warned would happen, despite the fact that tariffs are not having a direct impact on airfares in most markets just yet, but it's being used to justify putting up those prices. There is, of course, the supply chain issues in that airlines have struggled to take deliveries, something we've also covered extensively. And as a result, there are fewer frequencies than some airlines would like or to have been able to operate. And if they don't have the luxury of wide body aircraft, then it means smaller aircraft are filling up faster. Now, what does that mean? It means that typically where an airline would be able to offer an additional flight to popular summer destinations, Italy, Greece, Spain, where they are not able to because they don't have that extra capacity and the aircraft that they do have on those routes are filling up faster, only the highest fares are becoming available to passengers, having it seem like fares are higher this year because of those constraints that we just mentioned. On top of that, we do have the usual European air traffic control issues, and we also have immense air traffic control issues in the United States. Nobody needs us to go too much into details to the shit show of Newark right now, and United having to ultimately cull so much of its schedule. We've got strikes in Finland, Finnair coming every day into my inbox announcing another wave of cancellations. So bit disruptive there as well. So there's kind of these usual factors that people have to be aware of in this period. And then you have the fact that our skies haven't been modernized year after year. They speak about how we need better airspace management, we need to change routings, we need to ensure that we're flying in the most efficient way possible. And it's just another summer where, guess what, none of that has happened. And what does that mean? It means that you are more likely in these next 12 weeks to board an aircraft, have the crew close the door, and then the pilot come on and explain that there is some kind of ATC slot delay, which leaves half of the plane wondering why they couldn't just have been left in the lounge or in the terminal shopping, eating, dining, whatever. And the other half kind of probably frustrated at the fact that there's a delay in the first place. The quick reasoning for that is that when these slot delays happen this summer, it is faster for the flight crew to be able to up the chances of reducing the delay if the aircraft is ready to go. Door shut, everything ready to go, cabin secured, and ready to push back and taxi. And started to see evidence of this over the last weekend. That was partly to do with the end of the May half term. And I think, as is standard in summer, it's something that people should keep an open mind about going forward. The only real kind of tip and trick I think we have there, Dan, is that those early wave of flights that leave the departure hubs between 6 a.m. and 8 a.m. typically are the least affected in terms of delays, because that aircraft hasn't been able to rack up 15 minutes here, 20 minutes there, 30 minutes there throughout the day. It's the afternoon ones that are a bit more vulnerable to it.
Exactly. I mean, especially with low-cost airlines, right, where they already, like Ryanair, has 25 minutes between flights. So just a couple minutes makes a huge difference. And I remember sitting at Copenhagen Airport in the lounge a couple months ago, I guess, already, and I was watching as I had a view of the low-cost part of the airport, and I watched as a Ryanair aircraft came in. And 1 second, I was watching people disembark. I started talking to my brother. I felt like a second later, suddenly, it was the same amount of people, but in the other direction entering the aircraft. And then it was pushing back as fast as it came. So it's crazy how tightly some airlines pack, you know, these turnarounds. And then you see even airlines like SAS and Lufthansa and many of the major European airlines trying to have Ryanair style turnarounds. So I often see SAS with 30 minutes, Lufthansa with 35, 40 minutes. And I'm like, you guys are delusional, because unlike Ryanair, Ryanair lines up all the passengers so that they are pretty much boarded wherever they can before the people have even disembarked, as the aircraft pulls in, so that
before the aircraft has even arrived.
Yeah. So that everyone is ready to rush on. That's how they facilitate that at a regular airline, where everyone is checking bags and people are not pre-boarded. That is just so risky. And that's why I think Ryanair, ironically, is one of the most timely airlines in Europe, because they don't play around with it. They know they have short turnarounds, but they do what it takes to make that work, which we don't see as much at the full service airlines.
You're right. The other thing, the other element that I noticed that I just saw is just something that airlines should massively focus in on, you know, speeding up the retrofit of, are these XL bins, these extra large bins, the overhead lockers, specifically on A320 family aircraft. And I say this because coming back from Zurich the other day, full flight, British Airways, and as you, I boarded among the first kind of three or four people, full flights, there's 180 odd passengers. Everybody boarded so fast. Why? Because there was so much overhead locker space that everyone had a bag, but everyone can get their bag on, turn the bag on its side and sit down. And we to the point that we were actually sitting, waiting for our slot because we had all boarded early, and the captain came on and noted that it was great how we all boarded so quickly, despite it being a completely full flight, and that we had to wait 10 minutes for our departure slot until we could push back. And I was looking around thinking that is primarily and purely because of the extended, the sized overhead lockers, which I just think if airlines really lasered in on this in terms of their focus and precision to seeing how that unlocks faster boarding, then you have more chance of getting away on time every time.
I know. I mean, I love those bins. Don't get me wrong. They are game changing. But the one drawback that I really feel you do notice, it's like, of course, I would prefer this problem over the problem of not having enough space. But when you board an airspace, ironic, they call it airspace, A320neo family aircraft.
Yeah.
Those bins are so big and so low that it is a world from what you experience on an A350, for example. It feels claustrophobic. It doesn't feel spacious or airy at all.
I mean, you are very, very tall.
I mean, this is what's going to happen on the A220 as well when they introduce those bins, because now it feels so lovely. But again, of course, we all prefer bigger bins. It's just like you're on such a small aircraft, you don't really have you don't have the option to have both. But it is something that needs to be talked about.
I mean, the other part, I guess, our advice to anyone traveling perhaps for the first time this year over the next 12 weeks when airports are busier, when flights are, is just familiarize yourself again with the updated rules. It's so patchy. Dan and I are traveling pretty much weekly, and even us, you know, we're arriving to airports not remembering if that airport in that departure zone or in that transit facility has the option to leave everything in your bag or take out the liquids only, or leave the liquids in but take out the laptops and blah blah blah. Just being ready, I think, is smoother and easier for yourself, for everyone else around you, for the staff. And for the staff, I hope that they remember that shouting and barking at passengers doesn't have them communicate any clearer. In fact, it makes the whole thing worse. And instead, just, you know, passengers doing their bit by being ready, and staff members at security just being conscious of the fact that if passengers are not understanding English, that's, you know, quite understandable given it's an airport and they're probably flying, you know, somewhere else. You know, communication is key. Calm, clear, and hopefully everyone could be on their way as swift as possible.
Precisely. And unfortunately, as you hinted out with Finnair, summer also tends to be the period of the most strikes. So the most disruption of the year tends to come during summer months. And a piece of advice is to always be aware, look into what is the reason of this strike. So in the case of Finnair's strike, this is actually within their control, which according to EU law EU261 means that you are entitled to compensation if your flight is delayed or canceled due to the Finnair strikes. Meanwhile, if France ATC ends up causing issues again this summer like they have the past few years, that is a situation where, unfortunately, it is an extraordinary circumstance, meaning you're not entitled to compensation. So make sure if your flight is disrupted due to strikes, you know the reason, so that if you're entitled to compensation, you make sure you get that, because that's the only silver lining in a situation like that.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And again, it's about kind of keeping that open mind to the fact that there are all these little factors that can go into making summer travel just that little bit more potentially disruptive than the rest of the year. But on the whole, things tend to go smoothly. Most flights, the overwhelming majority of flights, are arriving within 30 minutes of their scheduled arrival time, not least because airlines are padding their schedules and pretending it takes 2.5 hours to fly somewhere. Actually, it takes 1 hour, 50 minutes. So that helps them. But but generally speaking, it's we are in a better state as an industry with air travel this year and this summer than previous summers over the last 5 years. And airline chiefs that I've spoken with are quite confident that this will be that they'll be able to deliver the schedules that they have sold, most importantly, because that wasn't the case a few years ago. And that delivering on that, they'll be able to get passengers to where they need to be, reconnecting loved ones, families, relatives, summer holidays, all that, while bringing in revenue and hopefully building on the profits for airlines, for them to later invest in nice new cabins and aircraft for us, the passengers, unless, of course, they're Aegean, where they don't reinvest anything. They just kind of stare at their full bank account.
Amen. Exactly. And, you know, one thing we've been harping on about all year is demand to the U.S. How is it being impacted? And I watched an interview with Etihad CEO Antonello Neves a few days ago, which was very interesting because he was saying that people might notice the prices to the U.S. are lower this summer in general. You might not see it in your search, but their data suggests the rates are lower in general this summer than past years. But according to him, this has nothing to do with demand. It's the fact that capacity is at its highest level on transatlantic flights. So there's more competition driving prices down. It's not demand still. So that's an interesting little note there.
That is it's definitely an interesting take, and it's true of much of the global state of play in how capacity has returned this year from so many other airlines that had their aircraft parked or used elsewhere, now returning to those markets with bigger aircraft, not least the Chinese, who are offering fares on Chinese carriers. I was looking last night, Singapore to London via Shanghai, £249.
That's wild.
Crazy. It is much cheaper to come back from Singapore via Shanghai to London with a Chinese carrier. And these Chinese airlines are operating state-of-the-art A350s. They're operating new cabins, 787 Dreamliners, and so on. That's cheaper than, for example, if I wanted to fly to Frankfurt this morning for a meeting, that was going to set me back about €600 from London City.
Exactly. I'm just looking here at London to New York as an example. Obviously, the most profitable transatlantic route, the most profitable route in the world. And we do have one low-cost airline serving this market direct, obviously Norse Atlantic. And it's just crazy when we talk about why it's so difficult for low-cost long-haul airlines to survive, this is the thing, that if you look at the pricing here of, if you compare different airlines, I'm checking the middle of July, so really the peak of the peak. On this date, Norse Atlantic charges $490 round trip, and that's their lowest fare, nothing included, no meal. I don't even know if they include a second carry-on bag, but really the lowest. We're talking low cost. So $490. Then we have the likes of British Airways, Delta, United coming in at $520. So $30 more to fly a full service airline that gives you food and all this. And honestly, this price for peak summer, I really think is crazy good for a direct flight from London to New York on all of these airlines.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. There are definitely deals out there. And yes, as we had touched on, fares can seem higher to some markets. That's not the case across the board. And there's not this kind of key reason as well. Tariffs are not massively impacting fares globally or even across Europe and the US. Everything is patchy and kind of has its own story to tell as to why it's either up or down. And that's why Dan and I are here to help you navigate that. And we're also open to any of your questions via DMs if you are traveling this summer or you need assistance with that, as always, on our shared Instagram at On Air with Dan and Alex. And with that, we will move to Q&A.
Let's do it. If you ever stay at luxury hotels, whether or not you have status at those hotel chains, I recommend going to nonstopdan.com/hotels to check out booking your future luxury hotel stays there. Because by booking through a travel advisor like us, you will get a bunch of more benefits at luxury hotels like daily breakfast for two, room upgrades subject to availability, early check-in and late check-out, a $100 property credit or food and beverage credit, a welcome amenity, VIP status at the hotel, and if you already have status, this will give you even higher priority for upgrades. In fact, people booking through travel advisors get the highest priority for upgrades at hotels. So once again, go to nonstopdan.com/hotels to book your next luxury hotel stay.
Okay, so I've got this question here from Joe. He says, hello, Alex, a question for the podcast, and that he's also asked you this, Dan. He says that I saw on Cathay Pacific hiring that they have a post for hiring engineers in Beijing and Shanghai. I just wanted to ask, if there are aircraft mechanics in outstations, what do they do? Why are they there in outstations? And why are there managers and operations staff in outstations too? Thank you. The best podcast ever. Keep it up. Hope you can make it twice weekly. That's a very kind joke.
Aww.
So why are, let's get to some of these questions specifically. So why are there aircraft mechanics in outstations? Very simple answer. That's because aircraft require maintenance sometimes at the other end, not just at their hub. And so what many airlines will do is, sorry, what all airlines will do is all airlines will have a contract with a company at an outstation, and an outstation is anywhere other than their hub. So let's look at Iberia, based in Madrid. Iberia operate to Frankfurt, and they will have an agreement with an MRO, which is a maintenance facility essentially, or with some kind of engineering provider in Frankfurt, to ensure that if the aircraft is in need of some kind of service, some kind of bit of maintenance, have an engineer overlook it, perhaps a spare part needing to be factored in and replace an existing part and so on, that can take place at a location where Iberia do not have their own maintenance facility. And all airlines will have these agreements. And typically, it generally covers light maintenance. So it's something that the aircraft will need just to ensure that it's airworthy and safe to then get it back to its base where perhaps the full extent of the maintenance can take place. And all airlines have this. This ensures the safe continuity of airworthy aircraft and, of course, for us, safe air travel. So in big markets, so for Cathay Pacific, Beijing and Shanghai, some of its biggest markets, what they will do is rather than just rely on contracted staff or a contracted company, perhaps it is in their interest, in many scenarios it is, to have their own mechanics, their a mini maintenance hub to service the aircraft, to be there on hand, ready to provide maintenance as and when at all of these important hubs. And you've got the likes of Qatar Airways having this with markets like London and New York, where there are multiple flights a day. Emirates have this as well in markets like London and Paris. And this exists right across the board and ultimately is there for that reason. You are still saying the question, why are there managers and operations staff in outstation as well? Again, it's just to ensure that continued smooth operation, where sometimes it is easier or it makes more sense, especially if there are multiple frequencies a day, to have their own airline employed staff there, probably working with contracted staff or a contracted company to provide the maintenance. When, final point on this, when the maintenance is too big of a job for example, the outstation contracted company in somewhere small like Florence to provide it, and actually the aircraft needs that maintenance and ideally needs it at home, then typically that's when an aircraft is declared AOG. The aircraft is grounded because it needs maintenance, and perhaps it can't be done just, you know, quickly during the turnaround time. And then what usually happens is a team from the airline's home maintenance facility will be sent out with the parts to work on the aircraft to get it airborne again.
Well said. And then we have the likes of Qantas, that most of their aircraft spend most of their time on the ground in outstations. So you have, for example, Qantas has their own huge maintenance facility at LAX. because all their aircraft land at 6 a.m. and then they depart in the evening. So they actually do a lot of work on the ground at these airports rather than at home. I have a question from Kent. He says, I really enjoyed your video on how to fix Lufthansa's service. Thank you. I thought you had some very good suggestions and comparisons to Asian and Middle Eastern airlines. Sorry, guys, if you can hear drilling, that is not me. I wondered whether airlines have ever had any problems where they send employees on other airlines to see how other airlines provide service, or whether because airline employees often get free or discounted travel in their own networks, they aren't aware of how other airlines provide service. If you were in charge of an airline's service, would you send your employees on other airlines to see how they do it? Well, this is interesting because a lot of
employees... We discuss this quite a bit, don't we?
Yeah. And I mean, for example, I know for a fact that a lot of Lufthansa employees love flying standby on Qatar Airways because they get business on Qatar, which Qatar's crew don't get. But Lufthansa crew get business on QR. And I know that they prefer that over flying Lufthansa. So much of the time when I discuss what I think could be better and I give feedback on flights to Lufthansa crew, I ask, have you flown other airlines? Many times they'll say, yeah, I've flown the likes of Qatar, ANA. And then I go, so you know how they do it. Why don't you kind of embrace the same mentality?
Yeah.
And then they have a hard time giving an answer. But I do think that a lot of staff at European and Western airlines especially do have experience on other airlines and they know what it's like. But for whatever reason, some of them do bring it into their service, but then some just think, oh, I love flying Qatar, but I won't give that experience to people when I'm at work, kind of thing.
Or rather that they think that their senior managers had never informed them to deliver that level of service, so they're not going to do that because it wasn't part of the job description.
Yeah. So, I mean, if I were in charge, there's no way to just send your employees on other airlines because ultimately they're the ones who are paying still a bit. If they're on a standby ticket, it would be very expensive as an airline to provide tickets for other people. But you just need to train them, find people like me and Alex who have this experience, and then we can convey what that is like and how that should be instead of people necessarily having to experience it firsthand.
I think you're right. I mean, it's a great point. If I or we ran an airline, I would want my senior staff or my C-levels to make sure that they were across what other airlines are offering, because I think one of the biggest problems I find about airlines is that most people working for that airline only fly that airline. That is the most common scenario. And so very few of them are aware as to what their competitors are actually doing, what their competitors are delivering in terms of onboard service, or rather not delivering, and so on. And so those comparisons that are in the boardrooms, people are kind of guessing based on an article they saw or a video that they had seen. And it's like, actually, if you're in a position of power, especially if you are ultimately designing anything to do with kind of the service elements or the service on the ground, customer and passenger experience, cabin design, the elements of cuisine, onboard dining, in-flight entertainment, you need to get out there and you need to see what the competitors are doing so that you can take the best and worst notes from both in order to carve out something that passengers need. It is no good only experiencing what your own airline has to offer, because you're essentially going through your working career with tunnel vision. Many senior airline execs that I speak to are frankly and simply unaware that this airline has already been doing XYZ for so long, or this didn't work well, you know, with this curtain, because when they spilled coffee on this and this happened and so on. And I just think that knowledge is certainly power in this scenario. And so it's all about going to gain that knowledge. I also understand it would be naive to expect that, oh, you know, cabin crew, pilots, anyone working for the airline, you need to go off and fly other airlines. That's not, I think, where it really should be. It's in the decision making, so that it then filters down.
Yeah, perfect. Final question for today from Gabriel. He sends a photo that basically of a guy sitting next to him. He's an Icelandair Saga class, which is, think of a premium economy type of seat or US first class vibe. So he's in the window. The guy in the aisle seat is sitting with his feet on the bulkhead up above the entertainment screen.
I had a feeling
screen.
You were going to say that.
Luckily, at least he has socks on, but his shoes are off. And he says, what are our opinions on this situation? Because the crew did not say anything to the passenger and he sat like that the entire flight and obviously thought it was it wasn't great. So he also said, should I post this on social media to shame him? Because he didn't seem to have any shame about it himself. Well,
yeah.
I don't think there's anything wrong with... I'm not pro being passive aggressive, so I wouldn't like try to make some shady comment or do the same thing, but I would just be like, maybe ask if it's okay, like be like, sorry, it doesn't smell that good. Would you mind taking those down? Or the passive aggressive way would be to just suddenly go to the toilet once every 5 minutes. So he realizes, okay, I need to keep my legs down because this is really annoying. Or you tell the crew and you perhaps ask them and say it's bothering you. But I'm not pro shaming people on social media, so I don't know if I'd go that far.
Yeah, I know what you mean. No, I kind of agree there. It's just unpleasant, and I think it's just also bad manners. I think it's poor manners in the same way that you wouldn't put your feet up on the seat in front of you, perhaps on a train or in the car or whatever. I just don't think they should be on the bulkhead either. It's not a footrest. It's a bulkhead. It's just, you know, that's just the fact. It's not a footrest. It's a bulkhead. So can we just keep it as a bulkhead, please? And thanks.
Exactly. So, guys, we are going to take a little bit of vacation now. We've been, you know, working on this every week. I sit down and diligently edit. And now it's going to be nice just to have... Now it's going to be nice to have just... We love coming every week, but I think that we can make the podcast as good and potent as possible if we also take a few breaks now and then. And, you know, we've been going for almost 2 years with our longest break being about 2 weeks. So we will keep you guys updated, as always, on our Instagram, On Air with Dan and Alex, and on our personal accounts, so you know when we'll be back with On Air weekly. And we hope you have an amazing summer. You can DM us, as Alex said, if you have questions on our personal accounts or on the shared account, and we'll try to answer those throughout, you know, June. And we will see you soon on air.
Yes, looking forward to reuniting and returning with a fresh season later on in the summer. Dan, have a good break. And to the listeners, we wish you safe travels, and we're available, as Dan said, to answer any of your questions, tips and tricks as you navigate this busy summer period. Whether you're flying or not, it's always a pleasure, and looking forward, as I said, to returning later on in the summer. Have a good one, Dan.
You too. See you later.
Bye-bye.